following are some comments on William Shakespeare's Pericles, Prince of Tyre, Act 5. Deep clerks she dumbs. Marina, says Gower, earns her keep by honest means, not prostitution, and a hollowed-out Pericles sails into Mytilene's port. We have heard nothing directly from Pericles for some time now, so in Chorus 5, Gower prepares us for our meeting with him again in the next scene, simply by calling him heavy, quote-unquote, or sad, which, as we will soon find out, is quite an understatement. Act 5, Chorus, line 22. The restless ocean, the Pontos Atrugatos, or trackless sea of Homeric lore, has allowed one further twist in Pericles' strange odyssey. On the ocean, Pericles has already suffered one outright shipwreck, and one costly near shipwreck. Now he is swept into Mytilene's harbor at the mercy of the winds. A passive, worn-out traveler rather than a chivalric knight, or lord of heroic caste. This isn't the same man whom we met in Act 1, all fired up with the excitement of an erotic quest. Thou lookest like one I loved indeed. Pericles keeps his silence at Mytilene's port until Marina recovers him, and soon afterwards the goddess Diana instructs him in a dream. Act 5, Scene 1 may be the best time to remind ourselves that while the name Marina means of the sea, as Pericles said when he named her during an oceanic storm, as a common noun it also means harbor, a safe place at which to moor one's ship. This second meaning is significant here in the play's longest and most important scene. Marina serves as an inspired guide for Pericles, leading him back from storm and lassitude to a firm grounding in his true identity. She is the harbor for his life's voyage, as symbolized by many ocean crossings and hardships throughout the play. In the tragedies, the bedrock of human nature, the thing itself in King Lear's phrase, or at least as close as we can get to it, is someplace one doesn't want to be for long, if at all. Getting there leads to disaster, even if one may gain valuable insight along the way. In the present romance play, the Prince of Tyre has been exiled into the void, and it seems as if the experience drives him into a period of silence and nearly complete loss of self. He presents as all but catatonic. That is Pericles' condition as his ship enters Mytilene's harbor. At this point, Shakespeare dramatizes a miraculous recovery that seems all the more powerful because of narrations by Gower and Helicanus describing the emotional devastation Pericles has suffered. This formulation differs from what we find in Shakespeare's comedies, in which extreme loss is seldom more than gestured at, not brought home as it is in tragedy. In comic plays, the threat can even border on the cartoonish. Think of Aegeus in A Midsummer Night's Dream, threatening to have his daughter banished or even executed if she fails to heed his will. For the present romance play, Shakespeare crafts an exquisitely moving recognition scene that depends on, but does not overemphasize, our knowledge of Pericles' genuine trauma and loss. Pericles was convinced that both his wife and daughter were dead, Thaisa for many years and Marina by very strong circumstantial evidence. Pericles has felt these supposed losses deeply, and now at least his loss of Marina is about to be made whole. How then does Shakespeare manage the revelation? Lysimachus takes a barge to satisfy his curiosity as to who the traveler at harbor in Mytilene might be. Helicanus informs the governor that Pericles, quote-unquote, for this 3 months hath not spoken to anyone, nor taken sustenance but to prorogue his grief. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 20 through 22. Lysimachus has no luck in getting the silent sufferer to speak, but a lord reminds him that there's, quote-unquote, a maid in Mytilene, who might be able to wring some words from Pericles. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 35. Just when Lysimachus is about to hear Helicanus' tale about the prince's sorrows, the lord re-enters with Marina and her maids. The governor praises Marina, admitting that if only she were nobly born, she should be his choice for a wife. The young woman's one condition for her attempt is that only she and her maids should be in the room with the sufferer. Song and instrumental music have no effect on Pericles, so Marina says, quote unquote, "Hail, sir, my lord, lend ear." Act 5, Scene 1, Line 74. The promise of discourse has some effect, and Pericles blurts out a startled, and gives Marina a push backwards. Is there a premonition or a hint of recognition in these reactions? Soon, something more in the one-way conversation catches the prince's attention, and he blurts out, quote unquote, "My fortunes, parentage, good parentage, to equal mine." Act 5, Scene 1, Line 74, and Lines 88 through 89. Marina has dared to place her own sufferings and possibly even her lineage on a par with those of the princely stranger. That's mainly what appears to have sparked his attention. Pericles comes still nearer to his vital recognition soon thereafter when Marina, whose name he still does not know, responding to a question about her nationality, offers the strange response that she is not, quote-unquote, of any shores. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 94. But so far, all he can prove to himself is a likeness to the lost Thaisa in stature, countenance, voice, and stride. Might not his daughter, had she survived, have been just like this maid in all ways? In any event, he tells her, quote unquote, "Thou lookest like one I loved indeed." Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 115 through 116. Much has been made of this passage as supposedly implying or reinvoking the possibility of incest between the stricken father and his daughter, but this father and this child are nothing like King Antiochus and his much-abused daughter. The selfish and destructive relation between the former pair will not be replicated here, but will instead be replaced by a relationship grounded in respectful and chaste love. In biblical times, that love would be called charitas, or charity, not cupiditas, or covetousness. Now Pericles is truly on fire to know this young maid's parentage, even if she fears she'll be branded a liar for her efforts in explaining it to him. He hears that the girl's name is Marina, and a little later that she is the daughter of a king, and so was her mother. Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 133 and following. Pericles' responses to all this seem uncomfortably close to the skepticism that Marina fears will be her reward for telling her tale. For a brief space, he dares to believe only that he must be experiencing, quote-unquote, the rarest dream. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 151. Still, he convinces Marina to continue with her astonishing relation, and it all comes to light. How she was left in Tarsus as a baby, narrowly escaped the death that Dionysa had plotted for her, and was taken to Mytilene by the pirates who abducted her from the shores of Tarsus. Marina leaves out the part of the story that involves a brothel, presumably so as not to distress Pericles still more. Her final pronouncement to him is, quote unquote, "I am the daughter to King Pericles." Act 5, Scene 1, Line 169. What is Pericles to do with all this information? He first asks Helicanus for counsel, but the wise counselor simply doesn't know, and neither does Lysimachus because Marina never revealed her parentage to him, either. At this point, Pericles implores Helicanus to strike him physically into his senses, quote unquote, "Put me to present pain, lest this great sea of joys rushing upon me or bear the shores of my mortality and drown me with their sweetness." Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 181 through 184. These are not only beautiful lines, but revealing ones too. It seems fitting that the consummate expression of joy from a man who has suffered so much in and because of the sea should involve a metaphor involving the great movements of the ocean itself. Pericles is transformed by this strange knowledge, even reborn, as we can understand from his joyful address to Marina as, quote unquote, "Thou that begettest him that did thee beget." Act 5, Scene 1, Line 185. The last jewel in the revelatory crown is the name of Marina's mother. At the sound of, quote unquote, "Thaisa was my mother," the truth for Pericles is undeniable and complete. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 200. The end of the first scene in Act 5 is taken up with Pericles' rapt hearing of the music of the spheres, which flows from the celestial harmony ordinarily imperceptible to mortal humankind. At last, an exhausted Pericles sleeps, only to receive a vision of the chaste goddess, Diana. Her command is that Pericles should go to her temple at Ephesus and sacrifice, and when the priestesses are nearby, he is to recount faithfully his sorrowful experiences. The course is set for Ephesus. Lysimachus's inevitable suit for Marina's hand is granted even before he can get the words out of his mouth, and all that's left is the carrying out of Diana's instructions for Pericles' happiness to be complete. Now our sands are almost run. Gower brings the romance tale to port. All that remains is for Pericles to do what Diana has told him to do in Ephesus. In a choral interlude preceding Act 5, Scene 2, John Gower moves into wrap-up mode. Quote unquote, "Now our sands are almost run, more a little and then dumb." Act 5, Chorus, Lines 1 through 2. Again, he exercises his magical ability to whisk us through time and space to where the characters and we need to be. More about Gower follows in comments on the play's epilogue. Lysimachus's wedding to Marina is still pending since the goddess Diana's commands must be carried out first. "Oh, come, be buried a second time within these arms." Pericles recounts his story as Diana has ordered, and recovers the long-lost Thaisa, now a votaress at Diana's temple in Ephesus. In Act 5, Scene 3, while Pericles recounts his tale as ordered by the goddess Diana, Thaisa faints because she recognizes her husband by his voice and appearance. Cerimon steps up to tell Pericles that this priestess is the very Thaisa of whom he has just spoken. The pair embrace joyfully, and Marina, kneeling, is revealed to Thaisa as her now-grown daughter. The transfiguration of Pericles' attitude to pure joy is evident, and remarkably unalloyed for a romance play. He exclaims to the gods, quote unquote, "Your present kindness makes my past miseries sports," and tells Thaisa, quote unquote, "Oh, come, be buried a second time within these arms." Act 5, Scene 3, Lines 40 through 41 and 43 through 44. This seems like a total, if temporary, overcoming of the dreaded power of death, not a bittersweet reconciliation of the sort we will see in Shakespeare's subsequent romance plays. Helicanus is duly recognized as a loyal substitute for Pericles, too, and Cerimon is honored for the excellent role he played in reviving Thaisa. Since King Simonides has recently died, Pericles decides that he and Thaisa will be sovereigns in Pentapolis, while Lysimachus and Marina will travel to Tyre and establish themselves on the throne there. With this conclusion, we are as far as we can get from the selfish, wicked liaison of Antiochus and his daughter at the play's outset. The frame story of Gower's Confessio Amantis entails a long recounting of the sins committed by the protagonist Amans, the lover, against Venus, or love itself. So it makes sense that Shakespeare and Wilkins should shape Pericles, Prince of Tyre, as a story that moves its protagonist from his initially showy, chivalric pursuit of a terribly flawed companion to the divinely sanctioned love of a good woman and a beloved daughter. In Tyre and Pentapolis, two happy, generous, and public-spirited couples will serve at the helm of their respective governments. This is Shakespeare's basic comedic framework, and it lends the play's conclusion a sunnier disposition than we might have thought possible. Here our play has ending. John Gower reinforces the medieval moral framework of his tale and wishes joy to the audience. In his epilogue, John Gower points to the distribution of rewards and punishments by the play's end. The two happy couples, Helicanus and Cerimon, are all recognized as embodiments or emblems of their virtues, with Helicanus praised as, quote-unquote, a figure of truth, of faith, of loyalty, epilogue, line 8, and Cerimon for his learned charity, quote-unquote, line 10. Antiochus and his daughter, of course, died horribly, and so did Cleon and Dionysa for her wicked attempt on Marina's life and his participation after the attempt. Gower's final prayer is that the joy that reigns supreme at the play's end should transfer itself to the audience. The last couplet runs, quote unquote, "So, on your patience evermore attending, new joy wait on you. Here our play has ending." Epilogue, lines 17 through 18. There is at least a hint here that, as the audience has indulged the theater company's need for its patience, part of the, quote-unquote, new joy for the audience might consist in an opportunity for them to behold yet another such play as Pericles, Prince of Tyre. Finally, by his ghostly performance, John Gower joins the company of Shakespeare's famous chorus and epilogue speakers. Among others, we may recall the prologue of Henry V, with his stirring cry, quote-unquote, "Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention!" The concluding song of Feste the Wise Clown and Twelfth Night, quote-unquote, "We'll strive to please you every day." Prospero, in The Tempest, with his plea, quote unquote, "Gentle breath of yours my sails must fill, or else my project fails, which was to please." And Rosalind, of As You Like It, with her admission, quote unquote, "It is not the fashion to see the lady," the epilogue. The general request among such figures is that we, the audience, should do our best to repair the limitations or defects of Shakespeare's staged representations with our own imaginations, and perhaps, just as important, with our charitable spirit, our patience. Still, there is more to these first and last words in Shakespeare's plays, and all of them repay close attention for the insight they provide regarding the nature and purpose of the theater, the standing of the audience, and other matters. Feste's song lyric, as quoted above, can serve as an instance of such insight. He implies something about the value an audience might find in its theater-going experiences. Yes, we must leave the theater when the play is done, but we can always come back another day as, quote-unquote, the whirligig of time, to borrow Feste's earlier expression, spins round and onward. The theater, then, serves as an inexhaustible wellspring of refreshing departures from the sordidness and tedium of the everyday world. There is not such a tragically permanent scission between make-believe, so-called, and the real, as some dour critics suggests there is and ought to be. Perhaps John Gower's contribution as a speaker of first and last words has been to testify to the enduring power of poetry itself. He has returned to us in ghostly form to help tell what Shakespeare's friend and competitor Ben Jonson will call, quote-unquote, a moldy tale, in a way that Shakespeare's modern audiences can still learn from and appreciate. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Thursday, June 12, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.